refer to them in a little while, both of them, but we're going to be studying out of Genesis chapter 10 and 11. We're probably going to jump around a little bit between the two chapters because they are completely intertwined, and in fact, really the story of Babel in chapter 11 needs to be told to be able to understand chapter 10 and the divisions there, because the divisions in chapter 10 are really a picture of what happened after the Tower of Babel to the specific families that are mentioned in the genealogies. I said when I taught class a few weeks ago that I'd drawn short straw to have to go over this lesson, but then I heard the lesson that Grant did on the other genealogies, and he did a good job with it. And there was, I think, more names and things to read in the one that he did. So y'all bear with me if we read through chapter 10 real quick and the names that are listed out here. Missing seven. Can anybody share with somebody else on those maps? We need a couple to go around. I didn't print enough, I guess. I thought I printed plenty. I killed an entire tree printing those things. More trees. I don't have a paper mill. You got what you need, John? Okay. Chapter 10, verse 1. Now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The sons were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarmah. The sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. And these were from these the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, and Sabtecha. The sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. And from that land he went to the Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, and Calah. And Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, that is the principal city. Mizraim begot Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, and Naphtuhim. Pathrusim and Calhuhim, from whom came the Philistines and the Kaphtorim. Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jebusite, the Amorite, and the Girgashite, the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Avradite, and Zemarite, and the Hamathite. Afterward, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. And the border of Canaanites was from Sidon, as you go toward Gerar, as far as Gaza. Then as you go towards Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboiim, as far as Lasha. These were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands and their nations. The children were born also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder. The sons of Shem were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, Aram. And the sons of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arphaxad begot Salah, and Salah begot Eber. Eber was born, or to Eber was born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. And his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan begot Almodad, Sheleph, Hazamarveth, and Jerob, Hadoram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abimael, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. All these were the sons of Joktan. And their dwelling place was from Mesha as you go southward, Sephar, the mountain of the east. These were the sons of Shem, according to the families, according to their languages, in all the lands, according to their nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah, according to all their generations, in the nations. From these nations were divided on the earth after the flood. All right, if anybody wants to correct anything I just read, then you're more than welcome to. When I read it quietly to myself and I sit there and sound them all out, it doesn't sound too bad. When I try and read it out loud, I can't hardly do it. But basically, we have Noah starting out after the flood, and he has three sons that come off of the ark, right? And he has three sons that are going to fill the whole earth, as it says there in verse 32. These are the families and sons of Noah according to their generations in their nations, and these nations were divided on the earth after the flood. When we consider the three sons, what was their names? Surely everybody said Shem, Ham, and Japheth. We probably know which one was cursed by Noah. What? Ham. Ham was cursed by Noah. And where was who was the older brother? What? Shem was the older brother.
Jacob is listed first in the list. And the reckoning here, but usually you see Shem, Ham, and Jacob earlier.
That's how it's written. But in verse 21, we read, and the children were born also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder. So I was wondering if it wasn't reversed for some reason. Anyway, I know it's always Shem, Ham, and Japheth the way it's written, but then it says Japheth the elder. So my assumption is that Japheth was the older one and Shem was younger, but I don't know if he was the middle or the youngest. If it's reversed from Shem, Ham, and Japheth, then Ham would have been the middle. But anyway, I'm not sure about that completely. I just read that in verse 21. Do y'all know what the divisions were? Which general direction these families went to? He mentioned some places here, going east and going south, and the peoples of the coastline. But generally, if you look at those maps that I gave you, that first one that's stapled on top has a little color coordination that says descendants of Shem, Ham, and then Japheth in red, yellow, and, well, kind of a pink, yellow, and green, and their sons. Now, I didn't research for 40 days and 40 nights to figure out if everything on here was exactly right, but from generally, if you just look at all the red places on here, you have the descendants of Shem going east from Turkey, which is kind of that peninsula where Gomer says right there and where Lud is. They go east and then go southeast all the way down to the bottom of Arabia. The descendants of Ham kind of dispersed seemingly east, but they go a lot towards Egypt and Libya. On the next page that I gave you, if you look at a modern-day map of this area, you'll see a bright orange spot right in the middle. It says Turkey right there. The mountain of Ararat is on the kind of the northeast corner, is what I saw on another map that I was looking at. And so the boat would have landed there. And then from that area, it says that we're going to read in chapter 11, verse 1. It says the whole earth had one speech. It came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found the plain of the land of Shinar and dwelt there. The land of Shinar was between or down by the Euphrates River, which goes through what is now Iraq all the way down to like Baghdad over in that area. So if you look below Turkey on that green state labeled Iraq, you see Baghdad down there. Somewhere in that area is the land of Shinar, and that's where they built the Tower of Babel. So they moved from that northeastern section of Turkey, and as a group, as a family, Noah's family and his sons headed southeast and went towards the land of Shinar. When they got to Shinar, they were still collected and they still had one language. So what we're reading in chapter 10 is a whole bunch of different families with different languages. It doesn't say they have different languages here, but it says that they're, if you look at the end of each of their sections, for instance, verse 31, these are the sons of Shem according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands according to their nations. So it does say languages. But they're already divided in chapter 10 here. The description is of a divided people. And so by each of these names being given, these are families with an individual language already separated. So the story we're going to see in chapter 11 is really told in chapter 10, if that makes sense. But when they leave Turkey, there's a family of eight, and they're having kids, and within about 100 years, 106 years, I think it is, we have the Tower of Babel. There's a couple of things that I had read that said that, you know, by multiplication, there could have been several hundred thousand to a million people in that 100 years that were created that or came about before they got down to the land of Shinar, and they all had one language. It could be as few as a few hundred thousand, but it could be a million people also. As far as dates go, you know, we've been studying creation and Noah's flood here before, and I thought it might be a good time to back up on the dates and the age of when things happen. The creation happened according to one calendar that I found, and it seems to work out pretty good on most of it, but I don't know that it's exact on the creation. But someone took all the ages of these people and the bloodlines and names and listed them out and did the overlaps and deductions and came up with 4004 B.C., which would be 4,000 years before Christ was here. But then they dated the flood at 2348, which was 1,656 years later. So you have 1,600 years, more or less, between creation and the flood. But then, between the flood and the Tower of Babel, they say the Tower of Babel happened at 2242, which is 106 years later. Seems like a relatively short time period for all these people to exist, but then when you multiply out how many there were, some of these people that are listed here had a whole lot of sons and daughters, but then, or there's specific ones listed, but then it says they had more sons and daughters. And so, especially when you go over to Shem's descendants in chapter 11, verse 10 through the end of the chapter there, he lives 500 years and has sons and daughters. And so they continue to multiply as he went along. Real quickly, though, I did a little math myself on this 106 years to see how it worked out. And Shem was 100 years old. If you look in chapter 11, verse 2, I believe it is. No, I'm sorry. Chapter 11, verse 10. It says he was 100 years old when he begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. So he was 98 years old when the flood was on the earth, is how old Shem was. And then he begot Arphaxad. So he was 98 when the flood was around, but add 2 years to that. Arphaxad, it says, lived 35 years and begot Selah. So I took the years of all successively of these sons every time they had a child that's listed. And you have Shem at 100. We don't add that one. Arphaxad was 35 plus the other 2 years. And then Selah was 30. When he had Eber. Eber was 34 when he had Peleg, and Peleg was 30 when he had Reu. But Peleg's name means what?
Division.
And it says he was named Peleg because in his days the world was divided or the world was separated. And so when you add the 35, 30, and 34, and the two up, you come up with right at 104, 102, something like that. So within a few years of Peleg being born, a couple, 3 years after he's born, which would be the 106, the world was divided. So in his lifetime, Eber had Peleg, named him Division, and then a couple of 3 years later, at some point in there, the world was divided. So about 100 years, 106 years after the flood. Does everybody understand what I just said? I hate to repeat that. All right. Rose is over there shaking her head. Yes, she's already got a whole three-ring binder of all this stuff. I called her last night and got all this stuff, so if it's not right, y'all get after her. Anyway, another thing, while we're talking about those dates, while we still got that in our head. So Peleg was 30 years old. He had Reu, and he was 32 when he had Serug. He was 30 when he had Nahor. Who was Nahor? We're getting close enough to remember who Nahor was. Grandfather of Abraham. Nahor was 29 when he had Terah. Terah was Abraham's father. Terah was 70 when he had Abraham. That adds up to 290 years. That means Abraham was born 290 years after what? After the flood. How long did Shem live?
Age 600.
Well, in Shem's descendants, in verse 10, it says the genealogy of Shem was 100 years old when he got Arphaxad. And then it says, after Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years and begot sons and daughters. So he either lived 500 total or he lived 600, however that's supposed to be read. But if he only lived 500, he lived within 40 years, 46 years of Abraham being born. If he lived 600, then he was still alive for another 60 years after Abraham was born, which is an interesting thought to just put this all in perspective of who was on the earth at the time. Of course, we know the flood had wiped out everybody but Noah. So Noah lived how long? 950, but how many years was that after the flood? 250 after the flood. So you see that in verse 29 of chapter 9, y'all studied last week. So all the days of Noah were 950 years and he died. But in verse 28 it says that Noah lived after the flood 350 years. So 350 years after the flood, Abraham was born 290 after the flood. So, he was born, 290 years after the flood. So was Noah alive while Abraham was born? He would have been, right? And I think Shem was alive. So Noah and Shem were still on the earth when Abraham was born. Now, that doesn't mean that he was an old man at the time, but he would have been 50 or 60 years old, but he didn't have kids by the time those two were gone. Is there any thoughts about that? I think it's interesting. I don't know that it's life-altering for us, but the relationship and I think one of the things I took away from it when I was just reading that and trying to make that connection was that this wasn't something that was just being assumed or figured out later or by archaeology or, you know, some scientist went and found a bunch of ruins and, you know, dated this thing and dated that thing and put it all together and gave an approximate date. These men were there to talk to one to the next, to the next, to the next, and pass on this stuff. And their languages were also confounded and they were distributed. And I don't know if Noah and Shem ended up in the same place in Ur of the Chaldees, or if they were somewhere else or just stayed in Ararat or close to to Turkey, and then everybody else was moving south. We don't know any of that. It just says they were one people, one language, and were moving south and came to the land of the Valley of Shinar, and when they got to build the Tower of Babel. But that means that Noah was around when the Tower of Babel was built, or was tried to be built, and when the languages were confounded. And Shem was around, all those older, we don't know about the other brothers, but they were all around and they all saw the division of the world. When Noah came off the ark and they made sacrifice. What was one of the commandments that God gave Noah and his family to do in the earth? Be fruitful and multiply. Go out throughout the world. Same thing that he had given in the beginning, right? In creation. And so they were to do the same thing. That was a law that God gave them. That's what he expected them to do. So when we get into chapter 11 and they're all here in the Tower of Babel, are they doing what they're supposed to be doing? Not really. Okay. Is there any questions over those general divisions? We'll be going back into chapter 10 in a minute. Let me read chapter 11, verse 1 through 9. It says, "Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found the plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us take and make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth.' But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, 'Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech.' So the Lord scattered them abroad from over the face of the earth, all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth." So we have the people all in one place. They've come down from Turkey or from Mount Ararat. They've moved down to this plain in the land of Shinar. It says this: "It came past as they journeyed from the east, that they found the plain of it." So they discovered it. It wasn't that they knew about it or that it existed. They were all together in their journeying, and they find this place. And so to have that many people in one place, it had to be well watered. It would have to have all the resources they needed. And so they decided to build a city. Now let's go back to verse 10 of chapter 10. In verse 8, Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. In verse 10 it says, "In the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh, and the land of Shinar." So here we have, this is why I was telling you earlier, chapter 10 is kind of predates, or is after 11, because, or part of 11. He's in the land of Shinar, and he builds the city of Babel. So Nimrod is there, and he's obviously in the leadership position, and he says, "We're going to build Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar." So now we see him building in the land of Shinar. In verse 11 of chapter 10, it says, "And from that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, and Calah." Why did he leave Babel and all the cities he just built in Babel in that area, in Shinar, and go to Assyria and build Nineveh? Yeah, because his Lord confused his language. He couldn't speak the same language he was speaking yesterday. So, but did that stop him? It didn't really seem to slow him down much. He just went somewhere else and built more cities, which is what everybody did. They all went different places and built other cities up. And so he was obviously a great leader as far as man goes, and went from one place to the next and continued doing what he did best. In verse 3, it said, "Let us come together and make bricks." This is chapter 11. "Come, let's make bricks, bake them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and asphalt for mortar. Another thing that occurred to me when I read that this time was, you know, when we go to, I went to a couple museums in Texas with the girls this last week. And they weren't natural history museums. One of them was an art museum, but it had some natural history stuff because it was a lot of Indian art and whatever. And they were talking about the, you know, a million years ago when these Indians came here, and the subset of Indians that were before them in that area, the Native Americans, and how primitive everything was, and they didn't know how to build anything. All they could do was kind of lash some branches together and make huts and whatever. And then when you read this and you think we're only 1,500 years after creation and the world's been destroyed and all the seemingly technology of the world has been destroyed again, and then 100 years after the flood, there's a family that goes out there and says, hey, let's just make bricks. Well, I don't know if any of y'all have ever seen anybody make bricks, but making bricks is an ordeal, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort, and it takes some technology. You have to understand a whole lot of things about the properties of the materials you're working with. Just one little thing real quick about bricks. There's a compressive strength of certain kinds of bricks. They can take more weight than other ones. Well, if you wanted to build a tower, even if it was just the height of a pyramid, and I've never seen a pyramid, and I know some of y'all have seen pyramids, and they're really tall, but the strength of a single brick under the load of all the rest of the bricks up above has to be seriously impressively made and designed. And so these weren't idiots. If they decided they were going to build a tower and they were going to make their own bricks and use, as it says here, asphalt for mortar, they had to obtain the asphalt in quantity. They had to obtain the dirt in quantity to make the bricks. They had to know what they were doing and how to fire them and how to do it correctly to get the result they wanted. You see towers and pyramids and buildings built all over the world from these early days, and after this dispersion, in basically every continent in the world, there's some kind of a pyramid built by early peoples, and they're all built in similar fashions with similar type materials and put together in a similar way. And the technology that they were using was highly advanced for what they did. And it's not that somebody today couldn't build what they built. It's just amazing that they built what they built without some of the stuff that we have today to build it. And so these weren't stupid people. They weren't cave dwellers. They weren't cavemen like we think of and you see in these natural history museums. These were smart people. And not to revert back to earlier in Genesis, but you remember just right after some of the children of Cain were workers of iron and bronze and all those things. I mean, it was amazing what they were into. Well, if you had some sheets of bronze and iron and you had a forge and you had the tools and the blacksmith tools and the foundry already built, then that wouldn't be too impressive. But for you to go and find the raw materials and make alloys and then purify those and then design something to make out of it and build the tools to make it, it's all pretty impressive. So God had given them the knowledge they needed, but he also had allowed them to retain a certain amount of knowledge. Obviously, Noah had just built a humongous ark, and his sons had the ability to build and knew how to do things. So they get together, they put all their resources together, and they say, we're going to build us a city and a tower that reaches into the heavens. Now, historically, there's a lot, some of those pyramids all over the world and structures and big cities from the Americas to Australia to Europe and Asia. There was a thought that you could build a tower up in the heavens to make it easier for the gods to come down to you and for you to get closer to the gods and that kind of thing. I laugh when I get to verse 5. In verse 5 of chapter 11, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the sons of men had built. Can you imagine God's perspective that these men, in all of their wisdom and ability, are going to build a tower up to heaven to access God, if that was their mindset and that they were that brazen that they could do that? And God looks down and says, oh, look at that little tower they're building. Let me go see what they're doing or what they're trying to do. He wasn't condemning the tower itself. He was condemning the reason why they wanted to build a tower was to raise themselves up against God, not necessarily to destroy God or to take advantage of him, but just that they were filled with pride and with self-worth and that they were not doing what he told them to do in the first place. So it says in verse 5, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one and they have one language, and this is what they began to do. Now nothing that they propose will be withheld from them. There's another thought that occurred to me was, why would God want man to be dispersed and be different and be separate all over the world? And I'm not sure that this was really a punishment in and of itself, that he was punishing all the people by giving them a different language. He didn't destroy them like he had just done with the flood. But what he did is he forced them to separate. And you think about if you had one person in charge. Let's say Nimrod was the guy in charge of the entire world. And he had one language and one people, and he enslaved his people, or he forced them all to do what he wanted to do. Well, then they would look at him like a god instead of God. And so God dispersed all these people and gave and made it to where they recognized again, every single family, head of the family, knew that this was something that came from God. There's no way they couldn't have recognized that. So they took the power, God's power and his knowledge with them everywhere they went. As they were dispersed, they would have known who God was, because they were all in one mindset, let's do this thing and raise ourselves up. And then God came down and said, no, you can't do that. You're all going somewhere else. And so they took the power of God with them. Over in Romans chapter 1, there at verse 20, it says, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew him, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, and became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became foolish. God's image and his being and his wisdom has been known by man from the beginning, from creation. And people foolishly have tried over and over and over in every dispensation, in every time, in every place, to raise themselves up against God, to try to make themselves wiser and to make themselves feel more relevant than they really were. And so God here in this story shows people again, right after the great flood, after he destroys the whole world. And we're just a few generations, very few generations between Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth. They're still alive, and they've told the stories about how God destroyed the whole world, and they're saved in an ark. And their kids had to have known this. Even if there was a million of them, there's no way that story didn't get told. And yet they still thought, well, we're all together. We can raise ourselves up against God. So Satan was having his effect on the world again. People were reverting right back to sin and were doing what they had done before the flood. And God chose to separate them to be able to help them understand his power and his glory again, and to help them to recognize that. Now, that didn't stand in the way of them going like Nimrod, being able to go where he went after that, to Assyria and build Nineveh and build other nations. That was what God intended for them to do. Is there any thoughts about that question, sir? Yeah, directly opposite. Right. Yeah, they weren't thinking about a language barrier. It was just, if we don't build something central, then it'll automatically force us to be tribal and have to go take care of ourselves. So let's make one central government, one central city, one tower, and put it in the midst of us so that we'll all have a place. So God wanted them to be separate. He commanded them to be separate, and so he made that happen. On top of the divisions, and I'm running out of time already, there was several. I tried to find the exact answer, which you know there's no answer to it, but I looked anyway, for the reason why there is what we see as oriental blood and, well, not blood, but oriental colored skin and eyes and, you know, the blacks and the Caucasian white, and why you have the different things. And of course, there's all kinds of theories. And interestingly, you'll see as you read different people's take on all of that, and even people, scientists who talk about genetics and mutations and all those things, you know, they say, oh, well, it was easy. Noah's sons were all three different, you know, colors. That's what one person would say. Of course, that's easily shot down because, like Ham, you know, one person said, well, Ham was cursed, and so he was black. Most of his family ended up in Africa. Well, about half of his family ended up in Africa, and the other half went north, straight north, and went up into what is now Russia, up in that way. And so those peoples up there historically weren't the same color. So who knows how it happened? I suspect that we'll never know, at least until the end of time, we can ask the Lord. But one way or the other, God confounded languages. Maybe he confounded skin color and features and, you know, the shape of people's eyes and everything else. There is no definitive answer, I don't believe, that we could ever find. It is interesting that a lot of, not just archaeologists, but other scientists have done linguistic studies of where language began and trying to find the center point. And there's by language deficiencies and language similarities and things that they can overlap. And their hot spot, you might say, is in the farthest north, and this is secular people that are studying it. There's the farthest northeast corner of Africa. Well, northeast Africa is not very far in the scheme of the whole world, from Turkey and from Arabia and that area. And so, of course, they use that as to say, well, we've proven it's from northeast Africa, so that means that the Bible's wrong because it says it comes from over here around Baghdad, you know, 1,000 miles away. Well, if they got it that close, I would accept that as confirmation myself that the languages came from that area. And we don't know what concentration of people. We see the divisions here, but we don't know what concentration or the multiplier effect of the different families were in one area versus another area immediately after the Tower of Babel and the division. And so you could have had a tremendous amount more language dispersion one direction than the other, and so it could have affected that outcome also, or skewed their results. But anyway, I have a tremendous amount of faith in everything that we're reading right here, that it is what it says it is. There's, Jonathan mentioned, in all these historic accounts of different stories from other nations all over the world, almost every nation has a story about the confusion of language and the beginning of why they're where they're at. And there's some pretty, I wish I had time to read several of them, but they're kind of hilarious. You know, it's some of the Native Indian ones in the Americas and some of the ones in South American Indians. And then you have some over in China and that area. But they have very close similarities, and they have a lot of the same underlying story that overlaps. And they came from the really old documented stuff from before Christ. They were written down as being true, that they came from somewhere else and moved there because their languages were confused and they couldn't dwell where they came from originally. Anything else?